A voice in Ferrell's head assured him that it was not reason enough, that he did not wish to partake of any more of Ruby's saliva, that he did not, in fact, wish to spend any more time with her than he did already. There might even have been a voice in there somewhere pointing out that if he were to spend more time with any of the girls, it wouldn't be her. When he joked with Sarai about marrying them all, he'd pretended it wasn't something he gave actual thought to, but he did. How could he not? He was a boy trapped with girls, and they might have been like sisters, but they weren't sisters, and they were, well, they were pretty. Sarai first, then Sparrow, if he were choosing. Ruby would be last. But that voice seemed to be coming from some way off, and Sarai and Sparrow weren't here right now, whereas Ruby was very near, and smelled very nice. And, as she said, they were probably going to die. The hem of her slip was fascinating. Red silk and blue flesh sang against each other, the colors seeming to vibrate. And the way her knees were slung together, one overlapping the other just a little, and the feel of her foot nudging under his knee, he couldn't help but find her arguments compelling. She leaned forward just a little. All thoughts of Sarai and Sparrow vanished. He leaned back just the same amount. "You said I was terrible," he reminded her, his own voice as husky as hers.
"And you said I drowned you,"
she replied, coming a fraction closer.
"There was a lot of saliva,"
he pointed out, perhaps unwisely.
"And you were about as sensuous as a dead fish,"
she shot back, her expression darkening. It was touch and go for a moment there.
"My darlings, my vipers,"
Great Ellen had called them. Well, they were darlings and vipers, all of them. Or perhaps Minya was all viper, and Sparrow was all darling, but the rest of them were just... they were just flesh and spirit, and youth and magic, and hunger, and yes, saliva, all bottled up with nowhere to go. Carnage behind them, carnage ahead, and ghosts everywhere. But here all of a sudden was distraction, escape, novelty, sensation. The shift of Ruby's knees was a kind of blue poetry, and when you're that close to someone, you don't see their movements so much as feel the compression of air between you. The slip of flesh, the glide. Ruby twisted, and with a simple serpentine slink, she was in Ferrell's lap. Her lips found his. She was unsubtle with her tongue. Their hands joined the party, and there seemed dozens of them instead of four. And there were words, too, because Ruby and Ferrell hadn't yet learned that you can't really talk and kiss at the same time. So it took a moment to sort that out.
"I guess I'll give you another chance,"
conceded a breathless Ferrell.
"It's me giving you another chance,"
Ruby corrected, a string of the aforementioned saliva glistening between their lips when she drew back to speak.
"How do I know you won't burn me?"
Ferrell asked, even as he slid his hand down over her hip.
"Oh,"
said Ruby, unconcerned.
"That could only happen if I completely lost track of myself."
Tongues darted, collided.
"You'd have to be really good."
Teeth clashed, noses bumped.
"I'm not worried."
Ferrell almost took offense, as well he might. But by then there were a number of rather agreeable things happening. And so he learned to hold his tongue, or rather, to put it to a more interesting purpose than arguing. You might think lips and tongues would run out of things to try, but they really don't.
"Put your hand here,"
breathed Ruby, and he obeyed.
"Now here,"
she commanded, and he did not. To her satisfaction, Ferrell's hands had 100 ideas of their own, and none of them were boring. The heart of the citadel was empty of ghosts. For the first time in a decade, Minya had it to herself. She sat on the walkway that wound round the circumference of the big spherical room, her legs dangling over the edge, her very thin, very short legs. They weren't swinging. There was nothing childlike or carefree in the pose. There was a very scarcity of life in the pose, except for a subtle rocking back and forth. She was rigid. Her eyes were open, her face blank. Her back was straight, and her dirty hands made fists so tight her knuckles looked ready to split. Her lips were moving, barely. There was something she was whispering, over and over. She was back in time 15 years, seeing this room on a different day. The day. The day to which she was eternally skewered, like a moth stuck through the thorax by a long, shining pin. That day, she had scooped 2 babies up and held them both with 1 arm. They hadn't liked that, and neither had her arm, but she'd needed the other to drag the toddlers. Their 2 little hands gripped in her 1, slick and slippery with sweat. 2 babies in 1 arm, 2 toddlers stumbling beside her. She'd brought them here, shoved them through the gap in the nearly closed door, and turned to race back for more. But there weren't to be any more. She was halfway to the nursery when the screaming started. It felt, sometimes, as though she were frozen inside the moment that she'd skidded to a halt at the sound of those screams. She was the oldest child in the nursery by then. Kiska, who could read minds, had been the last led away by Koriko, never to return. Before her, it was Weren, whose screams sowed panic in the minds of all who heard it. As for Minya, she knew what her gift was. She'd known for months, but she wasn't letting on. Once they found out, they took you away. So she kept a secret from the goddess of secrets, and stayed in the nursery as long as she could. And so she was still there the day the humans rose up and murdered their masters. And that would have been fine with her. She had no love for the gods. If they'd only stopped there. She was still in that hallway, hearing those screams and their terrible, bloody dwindle. She would always be there. And her arms would always be too small, just as they had been that day. In one vital way, though, she was different. She would never again allow weakness or softness, fear or ineptitude to hold her frozen. She hadn't known yet what she was capable of. Her gift had been untested. Of course it had been. If she'd tested it, Koriko would have found her out and taken her away. And so she hadn't known the fullness of her power. She could have saved them all, if only she'd known. There was so much death in the citadel that day. She could have bound those ghosts, even the gods' ghosts. Imagine. Imagine. She might have bound the gods themselves into her service. Scathis, too. If only she'd known what to do. She could have made an army then, and cut down the Godslayer and all the others before they ever reached the nursery. Instead, she had saved 4, and so she would always be stuck in that hallway, hearing those screams cut away 1 by 1, and doing nothing. Her lips were still moving, whispering the same words over and over.
They were all I could carry. They were all I could carry.
There was no echo, no reverberation. If anything, the room ate sound. It swallowed her voice, her words, and her eternal, inadequate apology. But not her memories. She would never be rid of those.
They were all I could carry. They were all I could carry.
Chapter 32. The Space Between Nightmares. Sarai woke up gagging on the feel of 100 damp moths cramming themselves down her throat. It was so real,
so real. She actually believed it was her moths, that she had to choke them down, cloying and clogging and alive. There was the taste of salt and soot. Salt from the tears of dreamers, soot from the chimneys of weep. And even after she caught her breath and knew the nightmare for what it was, she could still taste them.
Thank you, Minya, for this fresh horror.
It wasn't the day's first horror, not even close. Her prayer to Lal had gone unanswered. She'd hardly slept an hour altogether, and what little sleep she'd had was far from restful. She had dreamed her own death a half dozen different ways, as though her mind were making up a list of choices, a menu, as it were, of ways to die. Poison, drowning, falling, stabbing, mauling. She was even burned alive by the citizens of Weep. And in between deaths, she was... what? She was a girl in a dark wood who has heard a twig snap. The space between nightmares was like the silence after the snap, when you know that whatever made it is holding itself still and watching you in the dark. There was no more seeping grey nothing. The lull fog had thinned to wisps. All her terrors were free. She lay on her back, her bed covers kicked away, and stared up at the ceiling. Her body was limp, her mind numb. How could her lull have simply stopped working? In the pulse of her blood and spirit was a cadence of panic. What was she supposed to do now? Thirst and her bladder both urged her to get up, but the prospect of leaving her alcove was grim. She knew what she would find just around the corner, even inside her own room. Ghosts with knives. Just like the old women who'd surrounded her bed, despairing of their inability to murder her. She did get up, finally. She put on a robe and what she hoped passed for dignity, and emerged. There they were, arrayed between the door to the passage and the door out to the terrace. 8 of them inside. She couldn't be sure how many out on the hand itself. She steeled herself for their revulsion and walked across her room. Minya, it would seem, was holding her army under such tight control that they couldn't form facial expressions like the disgust or fear Sarai knew so well. But their eyes remained their own, and it was amazing how much they could convey with just those. There was disgust and fear, yes, as Sarai passed them by, but mostly what she saw in them was pleading.
Help us! Free us! I can't help you,
she wanted to say. But the thickness in her throat was more than just the phantom feel of moths. It was the conflict that tore her in two. These ghosts would kill her in a minute if they were free. She shouldn't want to help them. What was wrong with her? She averted her eyes and hurried past, feeling as though she were still trapped in a nightmare. Who, she wondered, is going to help me? No one was in the gallery except for Minya. Well, Minya and the ranks of ghosts that now filled the arches of the arcade, crushing sparrows' vines beneath their dead feet. Ariel stood at attendance behind Minya's chair, looking like a handsome manservant, but for the set of his features. His face his mistress left free to reflect his feelings, and he did not disappoint. Sarai almost blanched at the vitriol there.
Hello,
said Minya. There were barbs of spite in her bright, childish voice when she asked, insincerely,
Sleep well?
Like a baby,
Sarai said breezily, by which of course she meant that she had woken frequently crying, but she didn't feel the need to clarify the point.
No nightmares?
Probed Minya. Sarai's jaw clenched. She couldn't bear to show weakness. Not now.
You know I don't dream,
she said, wishing desperately that it was still true.
Really?
Said Minya, with a skeptical lift of her eyebrows. And Sarai wondered, all of a sudden, why she was asking.
She told no one but Great Ellen about her nightmare yesterday. But in that moment, she was certain that Minya knew. A jolt shot through her. It was the look in Minya's eyes. Cool, assessing, malicious. Just like that, Sarai understood. Minya didn't just know about her nightmares. She was the cause of them. Her lull. Great Ellen brewed it. Great Ellen was a ghost, and thus subject to Minya's control. Sarai felt sick. Not just at the idea that Minya might be sabotaging her lull, but to think that she would manipulate Great Ellen, who was almost like a mother to them. It was too horrible. She swallowed. Minya was watching her closely, perhaps wondering if Sarai had worked it out. Sarai thought she wanted her to guess, so that she would understand her position clearly. If she wanted her grey fog back, she was going to have to earn it. She was glad then when Sparrow came in. She was able to produce a credible smile, and pretend, she hoped, that she was fine. While inside, her very spirit hissed with outrage, and with shock that Minya would go so far. Sparrow kissed her cheek. Her own smile was tremulous and brave. Ruby and Feral came in a moment later. They were bickering about something, which made it easier to pretend that everything was normal. Dinner was served. A dove had been caught in a trap, and Great Ellen had put it in a stew. Dove stew. It sounded so wrong, like butterfly jam or spectral steaks. Some creatures were too lovely to devour. Not that that opinion was shared around the dining table. Feral and Ruby both ate with a gusto that spared no concern for the loveliness of the meat sauce. And if Minya had never been a big eater, it certainly had nothing to do with delicacy of feeling. She didn't finish her stew, but she did fish out a tiny bone to pick her small white teeth with. Only Sparrow shared Sarai's hesitation, though they both ate, because meat was rare and their bodies craved it. It didn't matter if they had no appetite. They lived on bare-bones rations and were always hungry. As soon as Kem cleared away their bowls, Sparrow got up from the table.
"I'll be right back," she said. "Don't anyone leave."
They looked at one another. Ruby raised her eyebrows. Sparrow darted out into the garden and came back a moment later, holding...
"A cake!"
cried Ruby, springing up.
"How in the world did you..."
It was a dream of a cake, and they all stared at it, amazed. Three tall, frosted layers, creamy white and patterned with blossoms like falling snow.
"Don't get too excited,"
she cautioned them.
"It's not for eating."
They saw that the creamy white frosting was orchid petals, scattered with anatomy blossoms, and the whole thing was made of flowers, right up to the torch ginger buds on top that looked, for all the world, like 16 lit candles. Ruby screwed up her face.
"Then what's it for?"
"For wishing on,"
Sparrow told them.
"It's an early birthday cake."
She put it down in front of Ruby.
"In case."
They all understood what she meant, in case there were no more birthdays.
"Well, that's grim," said Ruby.
"Go on, make a wish."
Ruby did, and though the ginger already looked like little flames, she lit them on fire with her fingertips and blew them out properly, all in one go.
"What did you wish for?"
Sarai asked her.
"For it to be real cake, of course," said Ruby. "Did it come true?"
She dug into it with her fingers. But of course there was no cake, only more flowers. But she pantomimed eating it without sharing. Night had fallen. Sarai got up to go.
"Sarai!"
called Minya, and she stopped but didn't turn. She knew what was coming. Minya hadn't given up. She never would. Somehow, by sheer force of will, the girl had frozen herself in time. Not just her body, but everything. Her fury, her vengeance, undiminished in all these years. You could never win against such a will. Her voice rang out its reminder.
A few minutes of disgust to save us all.
Sarai kept walking. To save us all. The words seemed to curl up in her belly. Not moths now, but snakes. She wanted to leave them behind her in the gallery. But as she passed through the gauntlet of ghost soldiers that lined the corridor to her room, their lips parted and they murmured all together,
To save us all! To save us all!
And after that, the words they'd only spoken with their eyes,
Help us! Save us!
They spoke them aloud. They pleaded at her passing.
Help us! Save us!
And it was all Minya, playing to Sarai's weakness, to her mercy. And then in her doorway, she had to pass a child. A child. Baha, 9 years old, who had fallen in the Uzumark 3 years ago, and still wore the sodden clothes of her drowning. It was beyond the pale, even for Minya, to keep a dead child as a pet. The small ghost stood in Sarai's way, and Minya's words issued from her lips.
If you don't kill him, Sarai,
she said, mournful,
I'll have to.
Sarai pressed her palms to her ears and darted past her. But even in her alcove, back where they couldn't see her, she could hear them still whispering,
Save us! Help us!
Until she thought she might go mad. She screamed her moths and curled up in the corner with her eyes tightly closed, wishing more than ever before that she could go with them. In that moment, if she could have poured her whole soul into them and left her body empty, even if she could never return to it, she might have done it, just to be free of the whispered pleas of the dead men and women, and children of Weep. The living men and women and children of Weep were safe from her nightmares again tonight. She returned to the Ferengi in the Guild Hall, and to the Tyzerkane in their barracks, and to Azarine, alone in her rooms in Windfall. She didn't know what she would do if she found Errol Fane. The snakes that curled up in her belly had moved into her hearts. There was darkness in her, and treachery. That much she knew. But everything was so tangled up that she couldn't tell if it was mercy not to kill him, or only cowardice. But she didn't find him. The relief was tremendous, but quickly bled into something else. A heightened awareness of the stranger who was in his bed instead. Sarai perched on the pillow beside his sleeping face for a long time, full of fear and longing. Longing for the beauty of his dream. Fear of being seen again, and not with wonder this time, but for the nightmare that she was. In the end, she compromised. She perched on his brow and slipped into his dream. It was Weep again, his own bright Weep that ill-deserved the name. But when she saw him at a distance, she didn't follow. She only found a little place to curl up, just as her body was curled up in her room, to breathe in the sweet air and watch the children in their feather cloaks. And feel safe, for at least a little while.
Chapter 33 We Are All Children in the Dark. Laszlo's first days in Weep passed in a rush of activity and wonder. There was the city to discover, of course, and all that was sweet and bitter in it. It wasn't the perfect place he had imagined as a boy. Of course it wasn't. If it ever had been, it had gone through far too much to stay that way. There were no high wires or children in feather cloaks. As near as he could find out, there never had been. The women didn't wear their hair long enough to trail behind them, and for good reason. The streets were as dirty as the streets of any city. There were no cakes set out on window ledges either. But Laszlo had never really expected that. There was garbage and vermin, too. Not a lot, but enough to keep a dreamer from idealizing the object of his long fascination. The withered gardens were a blight, and beggars lay as though dead, collecting coins on the hollows of their closed eyes, and there were altogether too many ruins. And yet there was such color and sound, such life. Wren men with their caged birds, dream men blowing colored dust, children with their shoe harps making music just by running. There was light and there was darkness. The temples to the seraphim were more exquisite than all the churches in Zosma, Syriza, Myelin put together. And witnessing the worship there, the ecstatic dance of Thakra, was the most mystical experience of Laszlo's life. But there were the butcher priests, too, performing divination of animal entrails, and the doomsayers on their stilts, crying end times from behind their skeleton masks. All this was contained in a cityscape of carved honey stone and gilded domes, the streets radiating out from an ancient amphitheatre filled with colourful market stalls. This afternoon he had eaten lunch there with some of the Tizakane, including Ruza, who taught him the phrase, "You have ruined my tongue for all other tastes." Ruza assured him that it was the highest possible compliment to the chef, but the merriness in everyone's eyes suggested a more prurient meaning. In the market, Laszlo bought himself a shirt and jacket in the local style, neither of them grey. The jacket was the green of far forests, and needed cuffs to catch the sleeves between biceps and deltoids. These came in every imaginable material. Errol Fane wore gold. Laszlo chose the more economical and understated leather. He bought socks, too. He was beginning to understand the appeal of money. He bought 4 pair, a profligate quantity of socks. And not only were they not grey, no 2 pair were even the same colour. One was pink, and another had stripes. And speaking of pink, he sampled blood candy in a tiny shop under a bridge. It was real, and it was awful. After fighting back the urge to gag, he told the confectioner weakly, "You have ruined my tongue for all other tastes," and saw her eyes flare wide. Her shock was chased by a blush, confirming his suspicions regarding the decency of the compliment. "Thank you for that," Laszlo told Ruza as they walked away. "Her husband will probably challenge me to a duel."
"Probably," agreed Ruza. "But everyone should fight at least one duel."
"One sounds just about right for me."
"Because you'd die," Ruza clarified unnecessarily. "And not be alive to fight another."
"Yes," said Laszlo. "That is what I meant." Ruza clapped him on the shoulder.
"Don't worry. We'll make a warrior of you yet."
"You know." He eyed the green brocade purse that had belonged to Calixta's grandmother.
"For starters, you might buy a wallet while we're here."
"What? You disapprove of my purse?" asked Laszlo, holding it up to show off its gaudy brooch to best advantage.
"Yes, I rather do."
"But it's so handy," said Laszlo.
"Look, I can wear it like this."
He demonstrated, dangling it from his wrist by its drawstrings and swinging it in circles, childlike. Ruza shook his head and muttered,
"Ferengi."
But mostly, there was work to be done. Over those first few days, Laszlo had to see to it that all the Godslayer's delegates were set up with workspace to accommodate their needs, as well as materials and, in some cases, assistance. And since most hadn't bothered to learn any of their host language on the journey, they all needed interpreters. Some of the Tizakane understood a little, but they had their duties to attend to. Calixte was nearly fluent by now, but she had no intention of spending her time helping
small-minded old men.
And so Laszlo found himself very busy. Some of the delegates were easier than others. Balabra, the mathematician, requested an office with high walls he might write his formulas upon and whitewash over as he saw fit. Kefa, artist and designer of catapults and siege engines, needed only a drafting table brought into his room at the Guild Hall. Laszlo doubted that the engineers needed much more than that, but Eblis Tot seemed to view it as a matter of distinction that the more important guests should ask for and receive the most. And so he dictated elaborate and specific demands that it was then Laszlo's duty to fulfill, with the help of a number of locals Suhaila organized to assist him. The result was that Todd's Weep workshop surpassed his Syriza office in grandeur, though he did indeed spend most of his time at the drafting table in the corner. Calixte asked for nothing at all, though Laszlo knew she was procuring, with Tsara's assistance, an array of resins with which to concoct sticking pastes to aid in her climbing. Whether she would be called upon by Errol Fane to do so was much in question. She herself suspected he'd invited her along more to rescue her from jail than from real need of her. But she was determined to win her bet with Todd in any case. "Any luck?" Laszlo asked her when he saw her coming back from a test at the anchor.
"Luck has nothing to do with it,"
she replied.
"It's all strength and cleverness."
She winked, flexing her hands like five-legged spiders.
"And glue."
As she dropped her hands, it occurred to Laszlo that they bore no grey discoloration. He had discovered, after his own contact with the anchor, that the faint dirty tinge did not wash off, even with soap and water. It had faded, though, and was gone now. The mesarthium, he thought, must be reactive with skin, the way some other metals were, such as copper. Not Calixte's skin, though. She'd just been touching the anchor and bore no trace of it. The Fellerings, Musave the Magnetist, and Thion Nero all needed laboratory space in which to unload the equipment they had brought with them from the West. The Fellerings and Musave were content with converted stables next to the Guild Hall, but Thion refused them, demanding to scout other sites. Laszlo had to go along as interpreter, and at first he couldn't tell what it was the alchemist was looking for. He turned down some rooms as too big and others as too small, before settling on the attic story of a crematorium, a cavernous space larger than others he'd rejected as too big. It was also windowless, with a single great heavy door. When he demanded no fewer than 3 locks for it, Laszlo understood. He'd chosen the place for privacy. He was intent on keeping the secret of Azoth, it would seem, even in this city, whence, long ago, the secret had come. Drave required a warehouse to store his powder and chemicals, and Laszlo saw to it that he had one, outside the city, in case of fiery misadventure. And if the distance resulted in less day-to-day drave, well, that was just a bonus.
"It's a damned inconvenience," the explosionist groused,
though the inconvenience proved quite minimal, due to the fact that after overseeing the unloading of his supplies, he spent no further time there.
"Just tell me what you want blown up and I'm good for it,"
he said, and then proceeded to spend his time scouting the city for pleasures and making women uncomfortable with his leering. Oswin, the farmer botanist, needed a glasshouse and fields for planting, so he too had to go out of the city and out of the citadel's shadow, where his seeds and seedlings would see sunlight.
"Plants that dreamed they were birds."
That was his work. Those words were from the myth of the Seraphim, describing the world as the beings had found it when they came down from the skies. And they found rich soil and sweet seas, and plants that dreamed they were birds, and drifted up to the clouds on leaves like wings. Laszlo had known the passage for years, and had assumed it was fantasy, but he had discovered in Thanagost that it was real. The plant was called Ulola, and it was known for 2 things. 1, its nondescript shrubs were a favorite resting place for Sapaes in the heat of the day, which accounted for its nickname, Snake Shade. And 2, its flowers could fly. Or float, if you wanted to be technical. They were sac-like blooms about the size of a baby's head, and as they died, their decay produced a powerful lifting gas, which carried them into the sky, and wherever the wind blew them, to release seeds in new soil and begin the cycle again. They were a quirk of the Badlands, drifting pink balloons that had a way of making landfall in the midst of wild amphion wolf riots, and would most likely have stayed that way if a botanist from the University of Isquith, Oswin, hadn't braved the dangers of the frontier in search of samples, and fallen in love with the lawless land, and, more particularly, with the lawless mechanist, Solzarin, favoured by warlords for her extravagant firearms designs. It was quite the love story, even involving a duel, fought by Solzarin. Only the unique combination of the two of them could have produced the silk sleigh, a sleek, ultralight craft buoyed by Ulola gas. The crafts themselves, Solzarin was assembling in one of the pavilions of the Guild Hall. As to the matter of when they would fly, the subject was broached on the fifth afternoon at a meeting of city leaders that Laszlo attended with Errol Fane. It did not go at all as he expected.
"Our guests are at work on the problem of the Citadel,"
Errol Fane reported to the five Zaedim, which translated as First Voices. The two women and three men constituted the governing body that had been established after the fall of the gods.
"And when they are ready, they will make proposals toward a solution."
"To move it?"
one woman said. Her name was Maldiga, and her voice was heavy with apprehension.
"But how can they hope to do such a thing?"
asked a stooped man with long white hair, his voice quavering.
"If I could answer that," said Errol Fane, with the slightest of smiles, "I would have done it myself and avoided a long journey. Our guests possess the brightest practical minds in half a world."
"But what is practicality against the magic of gods?"
the old man interrupted.
"It is the best hope we have," said Errol Fane. "It won't be the work of moments, as it was for Scathis. But what else can we do? We might be looking at years of effort. It may be that the best we can hope for is a tower to reach it, and to carve it away piece by piece until it's gone. Our grandchildren's grandchildren may well be carting shavings of Mazathium out of the city as the monstrosity shrinks slowly to nothing. But even so, even if that's the only way, and we in this room don't live to see it, there will come a day when the last piece is gone and the sky is free."
They were powerful words, though spoken softly, and they seemed to lift the hopes of the others. Tentatively, Maldiga said,
"Carve it away, you say? Can they cut it? Have they?"
"Not yet,"
Errol Fane admitted. In fact, the Fellering's confidence had proven misplaced. Like everyone else, they had failed even to make a scratch. Their arrogance was gone now, replaced with disgruntled determination.
"But they've only just begun. And we've an alchemist, too. The most accomplished in the world."
As for said alchemist, if he was having any luck with his alkahest, he was keeping it as much a secret as his key ingredient. His doors in the crematorium attic were locked, and he only opened them to receive meals. He'd even had a cot moved in so he could sleep on site, which did not, however, mean that he never emerged. Zara had been on watch, and had seen him in the dead of night, walking in the direction of the North Anchor. To experiment on Mazathium in secret, Laszlo supposed. When Zara mentioned it to him this morning, he had gone himself to examine the surface, looking for any hint that Thion had been successful. It was a big surface. It was possible he'd missed something, but he didn't really think so. The whole expanse had been as smooth and unnaturally perfect as the first time he saw it. There was not, in fact, any encouraging news to report to the Zaedin, not yet. The meeting had another purpose.
Tomorrow, Errol Fane told them, and his voice seemed to weigh down the air, we launch one of the silk sleighs. The effect of his words was immediate and absolutely counterintuitive. In any city in the world, airships, real, functional airships, would be met with wonderment. This ought to have been thrilling news. But the men and women in the room went pale. Five faces in a row uniformly drained of color and went blank with a kind of stunned dread. The old man began to shake his head. Muldigar pressed her lips together to still their sudden trembling, and in a gesture that pained Laszlo to interpret, laid a hand to her belly. Suhaila had made a similar movement, and he thought he knew what it meant. They all struggled to maintain composure, but their faces betrayed them. Laszlo hadn't seen anyone look this stricken since the boys at the abbey were dragged to the crypt for punishment. He had never seen adults look like this.
It will only be a test flight, Errol Fane went on. We need to establish a reliable means of coming and going between the city and the citadel. And,
he hesitated, swallowed, looked at no one when he said,
I need to see it.
You,
demanded one of the men.
Are you going up there?
It seemed an odd question. It had never occurred to Laszlo that he might not. Solemnly, Errol Fane regarded the man.
I was hoping you would come too, Shajan. You who were there at the end.
The end. The day the gods were slain. Laszlo's mind flashed to the mural in the alley, and the hero depicted in it, six-armed and triumphant.
It has stood dead all these years, and some of us know better than others the state it was left in.
No one met anyone's eyes then. It was very odd. It put Laszlo in mind of the way they avoided looking at the citadel itself. It occurred to him that the bodies of the gods might still be up there, left where they died. But he didn't see why that should cause such a trembling and shrinking.
I couldn't,
gasped Shajan, staring at his own shaking hands.
You can't expect it.
You see how I am now.
It struck Laszlo as out of all proportion, a grown man reduced to trembling at the thought of entering an empty building, even that empty building, because there might be skeletons there, and the disproportion only grew.
We could still move,
Muldigar blurted, looking as harrowed as Shajan.
You needn't go back up there. We needn't do any of this.
There was a note of desperation in her voice.
We can rebuild the city at Inet Sera, as we've discussed. The surveys have all been done. We need only to begin.
Errol Fane shook his head.
If we did, he said, it would mean that they had won, even in death. They haven't. This is our city, that our foremothers and forefathers built on land consecrated by Thakra. We won't forsake it. That is our sky, and we will have it back.
They were such words as might have been roared before battle. A little boy playing Tizocaine in an orchard would have loved the feel of them rolling off his tongue. But Errol Fane didn't roar them. His voice sounded far away, like the last echo before silence redescends.
What was that?
Laszlo asked him after they left.
That was fear,
Errol Fane said simply.
But fear of what?
Laszlo couldn't comprehend it.
The citadel's empty. What can there be to harm them?
Errol Fane let out a slow breath.
Were you afraid of the dark as a child?
A chill snaked up Laszlo's spine. He thought again of the crypt at the abbey, and the knights locked in with dead monks.
Yes,
he said simply.
Even when you knew, rationally, that there was nothing in it that could harm you,
Yes.
Well, we are all children in the dark, here in Weep.
Chapter 34 Spirit of Librarian. Another day over, another day of work and wonder, and Laszlo was returning to Suhela's for the night. As he crossed the avenue, that solitary stripe of sunlight, he saw the errand boy from the guild hall coming toward him with a tray. It held empty dishes, and he realized the boy must be coming back from the crematorium, which lay just ahead. He'd have brought Thion's dinner, and traded it for his empty lunch tray. Laszlo greeted him, and wondered in passing how Thion was getting on. He hadn't seen him in the couple of days since he'd hidden himself away, and hadn't had an update to give Errol Fane when asked. With just a moment's hesitation, he changed his course and made for the crematorium. Passing the anchor on the way, he skimmed his hand over its whole length, and tried to imagine it rippling and morphing, as it apparently had for the dark god Scathis. When he knocked on Thion's heavy, thrice-locked door, the alchemist actually answered it, which could only mean he thought the boy was back with more provisions, or else he was expecting someone else, because as soon as he saw Laszlo, he started to shut it again.
"Wait,"
said Laszlo, putting out his foot. It was lucky he wore boots. In the old days of his librarian slippers, his toes would have been crushed. As it was, he winced. Nero wasn't playing around.
"I come on behalf of Errol Fane," he said, annoyed. "I've nothing to report," said Thion. "You can tell him that."
Laszlo's foot was still in the door, holding it open some 3 inches. It wasn't much, but the glaive in the antechamber was bright, and he saw Thion, at least a 3-inch-wide strip of him, quite clearly. His brow furrowed.
"Nero, are you unwell?"
"I'm fine,"
the golden godson deigned to say.
"Now, if you would remove your foot..."
"I won't,"
said Laszlo, truly alarmed.
"Let me see you. You look like death."
It was a drastic transformation in just a few days. His skin was sallow. Even the whites of his eyes were jaundiced. Thion drew back, out of Laszlo's line of sight.
"Remove your foot,"
he said in a low, casual tone,
"or I'll test my current batch of alkahest on it."
Even his voice sounded sallow, if that were possible. Alkahest on the foot was an unpleasant prospect to consider. Laszlo wondered how quickly it would eat through his boot leather.
"I don't doubt that you would do it,"
he said, just as casually as Thion.
"I'm only gambling that you don't have it in your hand. You'll have to go and get it, during which time I'll push open the door and get a look at you." "Come on, Nero. You're ill."
"I'm not ill."
"You're not well."
"It's none of your concern, Strange."
"I really don't care if it is or not, but you're here for a reason, and you may well be Weep's best hope. So convince me you aren't ill, or I'll go straight to Errol Fane."
There was an irritated sigh, and Thion stood back from the door. Laszlo nudged it open with his foot, and saw that he had not been mistaken. Thion looked terrible, though, admittedly, his terrible was still a cut above how most people could ever hope to look. Still, he looked aged. It wasn't just his color. The skin around his eyes was slack and shadowed.
"Gods, Nero," he said, stepping forward. "What's happened to you?"
"Just working too hard," said the alchemist with a grim smile.
"That's ridiculous. No one looks that haggard from working hard for a couple of days."
As he said it, Laszlo's eyes fell on Thion's work table. It was a rough-and-tumble version of his table in the Chrysoposium, scattered with glassware and copper and piles of books. Smoke drifted in the air,
a brimstone scent to singe the nostrils, and right in plain view was a long syringe. It was glass and copper, resting on a wadded white cloth spotted with red. Laszlo looked at it, then turned at Thion, who returned his stare with stony eyes. What had Laszlo just said? That no one looks like that after working hard for a couple of days. But what if their work relied on a steady supply of spirit, and their only source was their own body? Laszlo's breath hissed out between his teeth.
"You idiot,"
he said, and saw Thion's eyes widen in incredulity. No one called the Golden Godson an idiot. He was, though, in this case.
"How much have you taken?"
Laszlo asked.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
Laszlo shook his head. He was beginning to lose patience.
"You can lie if you want, but I already know your secret. If you're so damned determined to keep it, Nero, I'm the only person in the world who can help you."
Thion laughed, as though this were a good joke.
"And why would you help me?"
It wasn't at all how he'd said it in the Chrysoposium when they were younger.
"You help me?"
That had been incredulity that Laszlo dared believe himself worthy of helping him. This was more like incredulity that he should want to.
"For the same reason I helped you before," said Laszlo. "And why was that?"
Nero demanded.
"Why did you, Strange?"
Laszlo stared at him for a moment. The answer really couldn't be simpler, but he didn't think Thion was equipped to believe it.
"Because you needed it," he said,
and his words pulled a silence over them both. Here was the radical notion that you might help someone simply because they needed it. Even if they hated you for it after, and punished you for it, and stole from you, and lied and mocked you, even then. Laszlo had hoped that, of all the delegates, Thion wouldn't prove to be Weep's savior, deliverer from shadow. But far greater than that hope was the hope that Weep would be delivered by someone, even if it was him.
"Do you need help now?"
he asked quietly.
"You can't keep drawing your own spirit. It might not kill you," he said,
because spirit wasn't like blood, and somehow people went on living without it, if you could call it living.
"But it will make you ugly," he told him. "And I think that would be very hard for you."
Thion's brow creased. He squinted at Laszlo to see if he was mocking him. He was, of course, but in the way he might mock Rusa, or Calixte might mock him. It was Thion's decision whether to take offense or not, and perhaps he was just too tired.
"What are you proposing?"
he asked, wary. Laszlo let out a breath, and shifted straight into problem-solving mode. Thion needed spirit to make Azoth. At home, he must have had a system, though Laszlo couldn't imagine what it was. How did one keep up a steady supply of something like spirit without anyone finding out? Whatever it was, here, without coming out and asking for it, and revealing his secret ingredient, he had only his own, and he had drawn too much. Laszlo argued with him, briefly, over whether it was time to let the secret go. But Thion wouldn't hear it. And finally, Laszlo, with a frustrated sigh, stripped off his jacket and rolled up his sleeve.
"Just take some of mine, all right? Until we can think of something else."
Through it all, Thion regarded him with suspicion, as though he were waiting for some hidden motive to reveal itself. But when Laszlo held out his arm, he could only blink, discomforted. It would have been easier if he could believe there were some motive, some sort of revenge in the works, or some other manner of scheming. But Laszlo offered up his veins, his own vital fluid. What motive could there be in that? He winced when Thion jabbed in his needle, and winced again, because the alchemist missed the spirit vein and hit a blood vessel instead. Thion wasn't an especially skilled phlebotomist, but he didn't apologize, and Laszlo didn't complain. And eventually there was a vial of clear fluid on the table, labeled, with a contemptuous flourish, Spirit of Librarian. Thion did not say thank you. He did say, releasing Laszlo's arm to him,
You might try washing your hands occasionally, Strange.
Laszlo only smiled, as the condescension marked a return to familiar territory. He glanced at the hand in question. It did look dirty. He trailed it over the anchor on his way here, he remembered.
That's the Mesarthium, he said,
and asked, curious.
Have you noticed it's being reactive to skin?
Hardly. It's not reactive to anything.
Well, have you noticed skin being reactive to it?
Laszlo persisted, rolling his sleeve back down. Thion only held up his own palms. They were clean, and that was all his answer. Laszlo shrugged and put on his coat. Thion's response didn't bode well, in its broader context, about Mesarthium not being reactive with anything. In the doorway, Laszlo paused.
Errol Fane will want to know. Is there any reason to be hopeful? Does the Alkahest affect Mesarthium at all?
He didn't think the alchemist would answer. His hand was on the door, ready to shove it shut. But he paused for half a second, as though Laszlo had earned this single, grudging syllable, and said grimly,
No.
Chapter 35 Blurred Ink Sarai felt thinned out. To be so tired was like evaporating, water to vapor, flesh to ghost. Bit by bit, from the surface inward, you feel yourself begin to disappear, or at least to be translated into another state, from a tangible one, blood and spirit, to a kind of lost and drifting mist. How many days had passed in this way, living from nightmare to nightmare? It felt like dozens, but was probably only 5 or 6.
This is my life now, she thought,
looking at her reflection in the polished Mesarthium of the dressing room. She touched the skin around her eyes with her fingertips. It was almost damson, like the plums on the trees, and her eyes looked too big, as though, like Les Ellen, she had reimagined them so.
If I were a ghost, she wondered,
regarding herself like a stranger,
what would I change about myself?
The answer was too obvious to admit, and too pathetic. She traced a line around her navel, where her Lilith would be if she were a human girl. What was it about the tattoos that so beguiled her? They were beautiful, but it wasn't just that. Maybe it was the ritual, the circle of women coming together to celebrate being alive, and being a woman, which is a magic all its own. Or maybe it was the future the mark portended. Marriage, motherhood, family, continuity. Being a person, with a life, and every expectation of a future. All things Sarai didn't dare to dream about. Or, things she shouldn't dare to dream about. Like nightmares, dreams were insidious things, and didn't like being locked away. If she did have an Alilith, she wouldn't want a serpent swallowing its tail like Tsara and many of the younger women had, who'd come of age after the liberation. She already felt like she had creatures inside her, moths and snakes and terrors, and wouldn't want them on her too. Azarine, fierce and stoic as she was, had one of the prettiest tattoos Sarai had seen. Done by Gul'dan, of course, who was now a conscript in Minya's wretched army. It was a delicate pattern of apple blossoms, which were a symbol of fertility. Sarai knew that Azarine hated the sight of it, and everything it mocked. The thing about Illiliths, they were inked on girls' bellies, which tended to be flat or only gently curved, and when in the course of time their promise of fertility was fulfilled, their belly swelled, and their tattoos with them. They never really looked the same after.
You could see the blurring of the fine ink lines where skin had stretched and then shrunk back again. The girls whom Scathis